That's not what this is about.
There should be an office in cabinet office that's an office of facilitation of public policy, and that should just be neutral people like me who aren't, you know, not really interested so much in only environment, only civil litigation, but, you know, just generic mediator, facilitator types who, that's all they do is they go around running these processes to get consensus on big initiatives that government needs to pass. You know, I was just going to say two little footnotes on John's stuff. The thing that it almost fell apart over, I remember very clearly it was around access to the justice system for more litigation.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the business community was very reluctant to see more litigation around the environment. The idea was
we put enough in, we thought, right?
Yeah. We were saying we were going to be proactive to make sure there are better decisions, so yeah. If there are better decisions, we shouldn't need to litigate.
Yeah, exactly.
But Paul Muldoon and Rick Lindgren were saying, no, we need to have more access to the courts.
Yeah.
And I remember the discussion because it went something like, why do we need to have that? Because we need it. Okay, well, why? And they didn't make a very compelling case at the table that day. And I said, next meeting, you come, you pitch your idea for and sell your case for why you need more access. They came back. They didn't convince everybody. I would say even I was not persuaded, and I didn't need to be, really. I was just running the process. But I remember you guys saying, not good enough. They felt very frustrated. We actually had to break into two rooms.
Yeah.
And I took Paul and Rick into one room, and you guys stayed in another one. Yeah. And I went into
You were back and forth?
Yeah. I said to Paul and Rick, you guys didn't do it. You didn't make it. You didn't sell your idea here. And they're not convinced. They said, well, we've got to have this. We've got to have something here. And, you know, they had their own constituencies that were, you know, really pushing them that there had to be more access. So I went back to these guys and said, you know, I just can see you're not convinced. But if this doesn't happen, everything we've done to date is a wash because there's got to be something. So we then reconvened, and we started with the wording about if damage happens. Like, it was literally, I was writing it out one word at a time on the board.
Yeah.
If harm happens, and then somebody'd say, or it's expected to happen. I said, or expected to happen. And we wrote it all out. If you look at the language of the bill, it's exactly what we wrote on the board that day, because that was the only thing that everybody would accept.
And that was the one great thing about this process, too, because you can consult on stuff, right? And you make it, provide advice. And then Ledge Council goes away and they draft stuff up and you get it back going, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
Right? Don't recognize any of that stuff. But we get a chance to do the whole thing start to finish going, no. That's not it. Go back and change it.
Yeah. And, you know, Marilyn Leitman should get more credit than she probably has received. She was the...
Who's she?
She was the legislative draft person on this. She was the legislative counsel.
Well, her and Sally. I mean, Sally was really important within the ministry.
Yeah.
So she then worked it out with Marilyn. Right,
Marilyn had done the Class Proceedings Act as well, and she's a bit of a, I know it's traditionalist, maybe it's a bit of a classic approach to relationship between government and public and how laws are put together and how kind of a very Westminster kind of model. And when she heard that the committee, the Class Action Advisory Committee, was drafting the bill, she was, I'm not involved. Not interested in working on this. I'm not going to be, a typist for a bunch of policy people, policy wannabes. So we had her come over and actually meet with the advisory committee to start seeing what we were looking for and what kind of drafting we were doing. And then she produced a first draft on her own and brought it back. And then we kind of used that common text to move that legislation forward. But she quickly got on board. She saw that it was kind of neat to work on it. And then Marilyn was brought in again to the Environmental Bill of Rights because she already knew all the players and she knew how it was supposed to work. So she was really key to this thing, both pieces of legislation.
Actually, I think there's two important things about the process that are worth recording that we've never really done very well. And one was that I think Ruth gave you a set of you're calling them terms of reference, but really it was more a set of principles of things that had been in her original proposed bill. And those were the things that had to be worked out in a certain way, so a more public participation, better access to the courts for citizens.
Yep.
I mean, I can't remember.
Whistleblower. It's the
whistleblower.
We put it right in the terms of reference.
Yeah.
That was part one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then part two was supposed to be the tools that achieve part one.
Yeah.
And
Because those things were each individually discussed as parts of the bill. I mean, even the Office of the Environmental Commissioner, that wasn't actually one of the things that had been preconceived in the bill, but it came about through the discussion as part of, and maybe you can remember better than me, whether it was better.
Part of it was just oversight of getting stuff done the way we expected to get it done, and where the government's ministry is actually going to implement what we've agreed to.
Yeah.
So they need somebody watching them. And
watchdog,
been good.
Watchdog was the word that everybody used. Exactly. It wasn't a commissioner when we first talked about it.
But it came late, right?
It came late.
All the other stuff out.
Yeah,
yeah, it came
and then late. Somewhere later in the process, you said, oh, we better have somebody to watch.
Somebody said, okay, so what if they don't do this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What if they don't do all these statements of environmental values and, you know, registries and what they wither it, they don't put money into it, who's going to make sure that it actually gets done?
Yeah.
And then we said, well, we need to have some kind of watchdog.
Now for some negative stuff.
Sure.
The task force was an impressive group, but it wasn't a totally representative group.
Yeah.
And so when, from within the ministry, we had to do whatever we had to do to ensure support, we discovered a couple of key groups were not involved in the task force. One was the farmers. They took a look at the draft, and they said, well, this looks like it's been written by some city folk. And they were right. It had been written by city folk, and it hadn't really been written with the perspective of somebody who's running a farm. How are they going to deal with this? So I spent a lot of time with the farm community, explaining the bill, listening to their concerns. I can't remember in detail how that was transmitted back, but it must have been, because there were some modifications made.
Oh, I met with them. I met with the OFA several times.
And
Donna Stewartson.
That's right.
Yeah.
And guy who's now come up on my screen again, Terry Daynard. Remember Terry Daynard?
Mm-hmm.
And Terry was an interesting fellow, very highly educated farmer.
Corn producer.
Yeah, that's right. Head of the corn producers. And he said to me after a while, he said, you know, we don't quite get it, he said. We're getting more attention from an NDP government than we've ever had from any other kind of government. They couldn't understand that we had to try and get them to at least okay the thing, not maybe thoroughly supportive. But in the end, we did. But that was quite interesting for me, because I'm a city boy too, and I didn't understand how this piece of legislation being proposed would apply in farming communities. And the other group were First Nations.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a tough one to crack, and in the end we didn't. What happened was I met with them a few times, and I began to develop the view that they weren't that interested in the EBR, but they saw an opportunity to use the EBR as a way of opening up some constitutional issues that they were interested in.
Mm.
And of course that's outside the jurisdiction of the province. And I remember going, and Bud Wildman was minister now, who Ruth had moved on, and said, you know, there's only one way through this, you have to come and meet with them, I can't do any more. And we went, we had a meeting, and you know, I knew him somewhat, but I didn't know his history, but I knew he had a certain credibility with the First Nations, and I saw it in action at that meeting.
He had been minister.
He was the minister at that time,
but
also of Native Americans.
That's right, but he had a history with them, and he was really frank. He just laid, he said, look, this is what we can achieve as a province. We can't do these things. And he said, there's no future, and they accepted it. And they said, well, we won't oppose the bill. We won't do anything against it, but we won't support it either.
I remember you telling me that. I didn't know about all that stuff that went before, but I remember you telling me that they're not going to oppose what you're doing. I thought, okay, that's at least one thing we don't have to worry about. The other one that we couldn't get involved was the Federation of Labor.
Yeah.
But did you try with the farmers?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and they just wouldn't, the OFA wouldn't...
They just wanted to be exempt of the Farm Practices Act. They wanted to just exempt us and well, apply to everybody
else. Maybe they saw what they were coming up with, they
changed their mind. Yeah, and then MNR said, yeah, exempt us too. And, you know, a Federation of Labor was, we couldn't get them on the task force. We wanted them on the task force, and they wouldn't come on. And I remember going out to their offices out at Don Mills a couple of times and meeting with them just to tell them what was going on, because we didn't want them to show up later and blow it all up.
Because they were also talking about indoor environment, right?
Yeah.
No, that's not part of it.
Well, people have their own agendas, don't they?
Oh, no, absolutely.
And when you have a process like that, it sort of invites your that. Yeah. The other thing, and this is negative anyway, the other thing I think that was I remember it was a surprise to the task force, you had in that report, in your report, a game plan for bringing on ministers.
Mm-hmm.
And we ran much faster than that. Mm-hmm. I remember coming back meeting, we said, well, we've got 14 lined up.
Mm-hmm.
What? 14? Mm-hmm. Because by the time this thing was becoming reality, there was some excitement in government. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say enthusiasm, but people didn't want to be left out. They wanted to be in.
Mm.
And so that was really good, I think.
Mm.
And we lost one subsequently, finance.
Yes.
You know,
and we struggle with keeping the other ones current, even to this day.
Oh, really?
Well, you know, read my part one report from last year. There's a lot of pushback these days.
Our task force report said that we expected the statements of environmental values to be rolled out over several years.
Mm. Well, that came true.
It's still coming true.
I would say, again, it's not negative, but I do remember that very well, because once the bill was passed, the ministry, like all the other ministries, had to produce a statement of environmental values. But when we read the language in the bill carefully, it didn't really look like what we thought a statement of environmental values could mean.
Mm.
And so there was this tension immediately, and it was with your predecessor. He said, well, you need a statement of environmental value. What's this? And I said, this is what the bill actually calls for. We hired, as a ministry, remember we hired Bill Leese, who subsequently became head of the Royal Society of Canada. I mean, this was a very outstanding academic, a philosopher, an old friend of mine. He said, Bill, help us through this. We had a few sessions with him, and he read it. He said, well, they're not asking for values.
That's great. An economist and a philosopher.
Well, philosopher. But I was back from... I was just reading it as an economist, man. That's fair enough. But he said this isn't really, you know, it's called a statement of environmental values, but the text didn't, in fact, you know, it was a problem.
Mm.
It was a problem. And I think that's why there's been an ongoing, at least in the, I don't know, I haven't kept up with it. In the early days, it was a problem for all the ministers. Couldn't work out what was really being asked for.
Well, I remember the discussion we had, because we talked a lot about sort of the business structure, business practice, business plannings, you know, mission values of corporations, and everything is flows from there into what you actually go do. And it helps people make better decisions if they know they're lined up with a value principle set, right? So we thought, you know, the purpose of this is to help people make better, more consistent decisions from the top of the house to those that are down deciding, planning, and, you know, whatever they're deciding to issue. Let's put a structure in like that that would not... say business planning or mission and vision value stuff, but statement of environmental values sort of came from that discussion.
Yeah,
to help guide decision making.
And absolutely, and at the same time in industry, you know, I was around and they were putting out these ethical statements, and that was very, you know, prominent and current around that time. So to me,
and useful,
and useful, and to me, that's, you know, when I look at that requirement, I still battle with the ministries. I take that philosophy. You know, that they do state your values, and it's signed by the CEO, so it represents to the people in the organization. They can make decisions according to those values with the confidence that, you know, they can't be called to task, because there's the, in our case, would be the deputy minister level, signed off on it.
Yeah.
And it's, although in industry, to this day, it is relatively routine, it has never been adopted by the public service. And I fight with them.
But I imagine it's routine in industry, but it's not routine in response to a piece of legislation. That's different. When you're doing something in response to a piece of high-profile legislation, you're very concerned to follow the legislation. So I think, you know, it wasn't that there was a lack of sympathy for it. There was concern that what seemed to be written down and asked for wasn't what you've just described.
But that's a lawyer's argument.
Well...
Because you know... That's the classic one I've dealt with, is it you follow, in some cases I've seen lawyers argue that, they argue, that's all that's required by legislation, so that's all it can be in there, And another kind of discussion or argument to say, whoa, but there's nothing in the Act that precludes adding more.
Yeah.
And I've heard both arguments used against me.
Yeah.
In this particular instance, the only one they argue is, oh, that's all that's required by the Act, so nothing else can be in there.
Well, that may be what they say now, but in those days when I think there really was good support for the legislation, it was just more confusion.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. I always thought that the point of it was just to make everybody stop and think about what they were doing and consider that the ministry's business was having an impact on the environment. Stop and think about that for a while. And then, you know, your decision-making should change.
But maybe it works better for other ministries for which environment isn't their main interest. But, I mean, everything the Ministry of Environment does, or at least if you're working in it, you like to think everything you do is good for the environment.
Yeah.
Anyway, I
remember Andy Roman's suggestion that, projection that the Ministry of Finance and the Minister of the Environment would one day be the same thing. They would merge them.
We're still waiting, right?
Yeah.
Well, maybe we're not. The Ministry of Environment is being eclipsed by the Ministry of Finance.
Well,
maybe it's the same thing in that our vision of environment will change. I mean, I found myself in court as the commissioner fighting the Ministry of Environment over issues about the statement of environmental values and whether it should be applied to decision making or not. Now that you know, I had to go to court against the ministry.
When was that?
It was in it was Lafarge's decision about 08, 09, something like that. And by the way, I won.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the Ministry of the Environment is required to consider a statement of environmental values in decision making.
Mm-hmm. But
I was in court against their lawyers.
Yeah, no, I wasn't questioning that. I was wondering though whether it was written with the Ministry of the Environment in mind or with other ministries in mind. Because the way Mike described it, he said, well, we wanted the ministers to think about the environmental implications of their actions.
Yes.
Well, that, you know, when you say that to people in the Ministry of the Environment, they say, well, what do you think we do?
Yeah.
So why would they go to court and oppose me?
Well,
because
I was no longer an employee.
arguing that they did not have to consider their statement.
No, absolutely not. I'm saying what the, and I can't remember it either, but what the legislation says a statement of environmental values should be.
Right.
Didn't correspond to our sort of commonsensical notion of what we thought a statement of environmental values might be.
But part of the intent was to try and improve the efficiency of approval systems within the bureaucracy.
Mm.
Right? So the values would set a high level expectation of the principles for decision making. That means people at lower levels could make decisions more quickly if they were aligned. I mean, that was the theory, right?
Mm.
And hasn't quite worked that way because of now, as I understand it, Betterhead now having worked for an agency of the Crown for 4 years about how things really work for a whole bunch of legitimate, understandable, but very frustrating reasons. We were trying to improve the process to get it down through, done faster, good decisions out faster so people could go ahead and do stuff, not wait for this, you know, giant washing machine to take place.
Yeah.
And it hasn't worked that way.
Just to go back to the process for a moment, because there is a little period of time there when the transition was going on, the Liberals were out, the NDP were in. Scott had introduced the legislation under a Liberal government, now the NDP were going to have to reintroduce the legislation. Howard Hampton was
the class action one.
Yeah, and Howard Hampton was the Attorney General, and just by pure coincidence, I went to law school with Howie and played hockey with him for years. And then he shows up as my boss, really, at Ministry of the Attorney General. But the legislation was in committee. And someone from the Attorney General's office, political staff, came to me and said, we're going to move some amendments in committee to allow unions to use the Class Proceedings Act. And I said, well, you can't do that. The consensus is the consensus. And they said, well, now that the bill's in the legislature and we're going to go forward with it, we're going to move these amendments. I said, I have an obligation to let committee members know that you're going to try and change the bill, and they will then come forward and not support the legislation. So you're going to create a big problem. But it was really close that they were going to do this anyways, and then at the last minute changed their mind and didn't do it. But just from the process point of view, I felt kind of an awkward spot there because here I was a public servant, but I had obligations to my advisory committee members to protect their consensus or our consensus, and here's my boss or government saying, well, it's once the legislation's in the legislature, you know, it's pretty much fair game for being changed, and for them to back off trying to make some amendments, I thought was pretty significant.
Well, I had somewhat similar experiences, not quite as conflicted as you were, but if this interministerial task force or interministerial committee wanted changes to the what the task force had agreed to, I on more than one occasion I would say, well, we'll lose the support of the task force.
Yeah.
Because of what you're saying.
Yeah. So.
Well, I mean, but that was important. I mean, you don't play that card if you don't have to, but it had to be said.
Yeah. It's really a testimony to the power of the process.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. It's a very powerful thing.